Good day. I'm Dr. George Bakris, Professor of Medicine and Director of the ASH Comprehensive Hypertension Center at the University of Chicago Medicine. And I'm here today with Dr. Peter McCullough, who's Professor of Medicine and Chief Academic and Scientific Officer of St. John's Providence Health Systems in Detroit, Michigan. Peter has got a distinction as being probably the only cardiologist that I know of who has as much knowledge as a nephrologist as far as cardiovascular events in people with kidney disease, and is the leader of the KEEP study, who succeeded me and has been doing a great job. So, Peter, good morning and welcome.
Thank you.
Today we're going to be talking about an issue that's near and dear to the hearts of many nephrologists, and that's the whole issue of EPO. EPO was thought to be a godsend back in the 80s when it was available and has been used. There are many clinical trials that many of you are familiar with, and these trials have not been quite what we thought they would be in terms of giving us the answers. And so, as usual, we learn from our mistakes. And for many years, it was thought that we should definitely not have the hemoglobin up around 13 or try to normalize it because we're going to kill people doing that. But the issue really is does that make sense? Or is it something about the dosing of EPO? Is it something about how we are using EPO that's really the culprit here? And I will tell you, this has been a long debate with the FDA and the scientific community. And there's no real clear answer. But Peter and his group have just published a paper in the American Journal of Nephrology that really sheds light on this issue and has really had the blessings of the FDA and many people who have looked at this. So that's why Peter's here with us today to really discuss this. Peter, good morning. So what's the deal? Is it the dose? Is it the hemoglobin? What's going on?
You know, George, the thing that always troubled me in this area is that the observational literature and the epidemiology never matched the clinical trials. In the observational literature, those patients with CKD who have the highest hemoglobins have the greatest freedom from cardiovascular disease and death from an observational perspective. Yet, as you mentioned, in the clinical trials, all clinical trials in CKD pre-dialysis, including the CREATE trial, the CHOIR trial, and the TREAT trial, all showed that patients randomized to a higher hemoglobin target and more erythrocyte-stimulated agent administration to achieve those targets had worsened cardiovascular outcomes. So in the CHOIR trial, we took the data and for the first time analyzed the data according to the dose of erythropoietin used and the hemoglobin achieved to really try to sort out what's the culprit here. Is it, like as you mentioned, is it the hemoglobin that's really contributing to cardiovascular events, or does it have to do something with the drug itself? And what we did is we analyzed 1,244 patients in the CHOIR trial, which is the correction of hemoglobin and renal insufficiency trial. Patients, in order to get into the trial, had to have CKD with an estimated GFR of 15 to 50, a hemoglobin less than 11, so met a definition of anemia, whether it be a man or a woman. And then they were, again, randomized to a low target or a high target. And in this analysis, we ignored the target and we simply looked at what happened. And we organized patients into three tertiles of hemoglobin achieved. Less than 11.5, that was the lowest. 11.5 to 12.7, that was the middle. And the highest was greater than 12.7. And what we found is that across these tertiles, there was no difference in terms of cardiovascular outcomes. So that was the first red flag. Say, wait a minute, if hemoglobin is really a problem here, certainly in greater than 12.7, we should have seen more cardiovascular events. And the adjudicated cardiovascular events, George, were stroke, myocardial infarction, hospitalization for heart failure, and death. And we found that the rates of events were approximately 23% across all groups followed over several years. Of interest, when we analyzed patients in terms of the tertile of EPO that was used, we found that those individuals in the lowest tertile of EPO used, which was less than 5,000 units per week, those individuals enjoyed the lowest hazard ratio for cardiovascular events. And in a stepwise fashion, as we went to higher doses of EPO exposure per week, there were greater numbers of events. And the highest tertile of EPO was greater than 1,095 units per week.
Okay, so clearly it looks like it's all about EPO and not all about the hemoglobin level, or at least that's the implication here. What are the thoughts, if you can share these, what are the thoughts with the FDA? What are their, I'm sure they've been chiming in on this for a number of years. What do they surmise?
Well, the FDA has had lots of presentation and testimony by various company representatives that manufacture erythropoietin or some of its derivatives, including darbepoietin, as well as testimony from experts. They have been, however, somewhat blinded to the types of analysis that we were able to do in this study. And the reason being is because of the strict rules of randomized trials. If a patient was randomized to a higher hemoglobin group, then we must analyze according to that randomization schedule. But when we start to look at these trials and just look at what patients received, it becomes clear that it's more the drug than the hemoglobin achieved. And the confusing concept is EPO resistance. And so many have just jumped to the idea that, wait a minute, it's not the drug, George. It really has to do with we give greater doses of drugs to sicker patients who are resistant to the erythrocyte-stimulating effect of the drug. So it must be a patient problem, not a drug problem. Well, it turns out that if we look at those in the highest tertile of EPO used and the lowest hemoglobin achieved and call those patients EPO resistant, it turns out, sure, that's about 11% of the population, George, and they do have worsened outcomes. But all the other individuals, we can't ignore the gradient of events that we saw along the lines of EPO dosing. If we were to find a sweet spot, if you will, in terms of where were the lowest event rates, inquire, the lowest event rates were those individuals who are at the lowest EPO dose, less than 5,000 units a week, and a hemoglobin of 11.5 to 12.7. Now, that hemoglobin range is well above any type of FDA target. In 2007, the FDA said, well, wait a minute, what we're seeing here, there could be a hemoglobin problem. Let's keep the hemoglobin target at 11. And subsequently, it said, listen, how about starting these agents below 10 and then just trying to keep a patient out of transfusion range? Well, we know quality of life really drops off with the low hemoglobin, George. And in my view, I think we have to really have a reappraisal of hemoglobin in patients with pre-dialysis CKD.
So this is a very important point. Now, one of the things that's been known for many years is that with the increasing doses of EPO, there is a dose-dependent effect on blood pressure, and blood pressure clearly goes up, not directly because of the viscosity changes in the blood, but because of direct mechanisms associated with erythropoietin. So the question is, in this subgroup of people that were on the highest doses, did they also have the highest blood pressures? Did they require more antihypertensive medication? Is the granularity of the data good enough that we can answer that question?
Well, the granularity of data inquire is not good enough to answer the question of blood pressure effect and dose. However, I think the events, if we look across the clinical trials and what we know with respect to blood pressure, are telling. There are sources of data to suggest in certain individuals, blood pressure really increases at higher doses of EPO administration. So that's been shown. It doesn't happen in everybody. It doesn't even happen on average, but there are susceptible individuals. Of note, the blood pressure sensitive endpoints in cardiovascular trials are always stroke and the development of heart failure. And it's interesting that inquire, the major driver of events was the development of heart failure, and in TREAT, a less susceptible population of heart failure, the major driver of events was stroke. So my view is, I think you're really onto something here. I think in susceptible individuals, this drug really does raise blood pressure or raise the risk of vascular injury. And these patients who are at high cardiovascular risk go on to have events that are really drug related. And so the topic of our paper really was cardiovascular toxicity. I think this is a very good example where a commonly used drug, in fact, does have cardiovascular toxicity.
Now, you're the first author on this paper, and there were a who's who of people from the cardiology community on this paper as authors. If you were going to recommend something to the cardiorenal board as an amendment to their current recommendation, based on what you know and this analysis, what would you say? How would you say we need to amend this? It sounds like hemoglobin level is kind of off the table, and we really need to be looking at dose, or maybe dose and hemoglobin together as kind of a guidance as to where to go. So have you thought about that? Is there any kind of insight you can give us on that?
Yeah, well, one of the things we recommended in our paper, George, is we are strongly encouraging the individuals and the company and the academic groups that control the TREAT database to do the identical analysis. There's been analyses that have looked at EPO resistance, and they've always been somewhat off target, kind of carefully designed not to expose the dose issue and events. The same could be done in the CREATE study. If other data sets concur that we really don't have a relationship with hemoglobin and adverse outcomes, that it really has to do with this dose exposure. And we looked at dose, George, in a lot of different ways. The dose it took to get the hemoglobin to its baseline level at 4 months. We looked at the cumulative exposure up until the time of the first event, and it was clear it was all drug. If the data are externally generalizable with one another, my view is that the FDA can relax its relatively strict guidance on hemoglobin achieved and become much more strict on the dose exposure to patients, and that potentially we could have some warnings that are more helpful. So patients at risk for stroke and heart failure as the two blood pressure sensitive outcomes could be positioned as a higher risk group for the use of these drugs. And clearly when we keep the drug levels down, let's say below 5,000 units of EPO, they would correspond roughly to less than 30 in terms of darbepoetin dosing per week subcutaneously. Patients should enjoy freedom from anemia, higher quality of life, and not be at excessive risk for cardiovascular events.
So, very good. Now, I want you to speculate on this. I always like to ask some controversial questions. Two questions. Number one, these trials have been around for a while. Do you think that the company had any kind of idea about this dose-dependent relationship in events when this was being designed basically kind of looked the other way and wanted to, ask the question in the true way, the way that was set up? And I'm not impugning anything about the trial designs. I think they were quite good, but I'm simply saying there's clearly built into this as a dose-dependent kind of relationship. Do you think there were any data to give a hint that there may be this kind of signal coming related to dose before these trials even started?
Well, George, probably the earliest source of information was a trial done by Tony Bessarab in patients with end-stage renal disease on dialysis. And it was curious that he showed those at the lowest dose of EPO treated and the highest hemoglobin achieved did the best. And that's the reason why it was such a surprise later on when higher hemoglobins didn't confirm events. And what we had found out is patients had gotten sicker over time and they were getting more and more exposure to the erythrocyte-stimulating agent. So the answer does exist in all of these data sets. If one was running a company and one was selling per unit dose of erythrocyte-stimulating agent, clearly the best approach from a company perspective would be to blame the hemoglobin. Because number one, it takes focus off the drug. Number two, it would allow the drug to continue to be used at relatively high unit dosing administration. So when the companies looked at this, they may have said, listen, our best company strategy is to go in with an approach with the FDA that we're going to analyze by intent to treat. High hemoglobin targets are a problem. As long as we keep low hemoglobin targets, we're okay. My view of the data in totality is that was actually incorrect.
Okay. That makes sense, and I would agree with that position myself. The last question I'm going to ask you is I'm going to ask you to totally speculate because we have very little data on this except in rodents. There's a whole new set, a whole new class of agents that is on the horizon called the HIF agents, and these are totally separate from erythropoietin or erythropoietin stimulating, working through the liver, and really not requiring iron, and really pretty nice, kind of the dabigatran and tacumadin analogy. They're probably not going to be ready for prime time before 2016, my guess. But if you had to look down the road over the next 5 years, do you think we're still going to be using EPO agents if these do pan out to be as good in 2018?
Right, George. I would say that there are clearly advances in this whole area of hematology, nephrology. EPO, about 90% of EPO is produced by the kidneys, and the major physiologic stimulus is hypoxia. But 10%, as you pointed out, is produced by the liver. And the gene that produces EPO and the factors that regulate that gene clearly are inducible. The liver can be revved up to respond to stimuli and start to pick up the load and produce endogenous EPO. And endogenous EPO, as far as we can tell, is probably not toxic at all. And it's the exogenous, very super physiologic doses that are the problem. So endogenous production of EPO could be one solution, and the hypoxia-inducible factors are a terrific approach. The other thing, George, is don't forget there's an iron reutilization defect. And when the human body gets sick, the liver produces hepcidin 25. Hepcidin 25 blocks the ferroportin receptor and basically puts a lock on iron utilization and transfer across the body, particularly in the bone marrow. And agents that allow normal iron trafficking between cells and actually, in a sense, take out hepcidin 25 are probably going to have a huge impact. And right now what we're doing is we're pouring in EPO because the kidneys aren't making enough, and the body's the liver's not picking up the load, and the body is resistant to it. And then we're pouring in iron because we have a blockade of iron utilization defect. And so these are really kind of using blunt tools, if you will. And as we get more sophisticated tools, I think we'll get the erythron in patients with CKD back up to the normal levels, and patients should really feel much better, enjoy better outcomes.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's really been enjoyable to have this cardiorenal moment with you. So listen, I hope the listeners enjoyed this. I certainly enjoyed talking with you. And thank you very much for enlightening us on this. So for Peter McCullough, I'm George Backers. Thank you. Have a good day.